Well, this morning I somehow got myself into the position of blending two kind of disparate themes in one service. Our annual Flower Communion service and the celebration of our theme of revelry for the month of June. As I was working on it, I was wondering, how did I get into this? What was I thinking? And I thought I could blend these two. The truth is that I was thinking, first of all, that we couldn't miss a Flower Communion service, one of our traditions. And at the same time, this was going to be my last service before summer study month and vacation. So I was in the mood for some revelry. After living for 17 years in Georgia in the United States, where winter lasts about a week in a bad year, I have a new appreciation for revelry when summertime arrives in Nova Scotia. And I'm ready for it. I wanted to... You'll see it later. The introductory slide was a picture of our church at the Pride service, Pride Parade. I think that one's from 2013, that particular picture. But I thought it was a good picture to symbolize revelry for the congregation. And as I thought about it, there's a lot of things that we do in a revelrous way. But this morning, to illustrate the role of revelry in life and in religion, I chose the Jewish celebration of Purim. I could have chosen the Christian celebration of Mardi Gras, marking the last blowout before the discipline of Lent, or the Hindu spring festivities of color and love called Holi, or the Muslim tradition of Eid al-Adha, the feast of the sacrifice, marking the willingness of Abraham to sacrifice his son. In fact, I could have chosen any one of 1,000 religious festivals. Revelry and religion are intimately connected around the world. Life can be hard, and the gift of feasting and celebration gives us all something to look forward to and an outlet for our very human need to loosen up a bit. So our lesson today on world religions, if you will be a quick introduction to the Jewish celebration of Purim. Now, as I do this, I know there are probably people here that know more about Purim than I do. I went through seminary, and I don't remember any discussion of this festival. It wasn't until I met the rabbi here, Rabbi David Ellis in Halifax, taught me a little bit about Purim, and then I did a little bit of my own research. The celebration of Purim finds its justification in the book of Esther in the Hebrew Bible. This is the story of how Jews in ancient Persia were saved from slaughter by the brave acts of a unique figure in the Bible, Esther. And I don't often preach a sermon based on a book of the Bible, but this book is actually quite unique. First, it's the story of a heroine. At a time and in a book of literature that is largely paternalistic, it celebrates one woman. Secondly, it describes an ancient Jewish family living in exile. This story is 2,300 years old at least. But it's very unusual to find a story in the Bible about a Jewish family where there's no mention of Torah, there's no mention of Jewish laws. This family seems to be very integrated into the society, into the Persian society. And finally, for the humanists among us, this is the one book in the Bible where there's absolutely no reference to God. Not anywhere in the book of Esther. It's up to the humans involved to rescue themselves from a perilous situation. They are the agents of God, if you will, in this book. It's a wonderfully told tale of intrigue and heroism that's well over, as I say, 2,300 years old. Now, it's not all good news. At the end, the Jews in Persia end up killing about 75,000 of their enemies. But if you're planning to rush home after the service and open your Bibles to read the book of Esther, which I encourage, this is a bit of a spoiler alert because I'm going to tell you the story in encapsulated form this morning. So, the most powerful king in Persian history, throws a celebratory banquet. After drinking heavily, he summons his queen Vashti to appear before him and his drunken friends. Now, Vashti has arranged her own banquet for the women in the palace, and she declines the invitation to come and appear before the men, to her credit. Well, this is an insult to the king. No one turns down a request from the king. So to preserve his honor, he has Vashti banished from the royal court. And he then conducts a search for a new queen. And he selects Esther. And Esther happens to be Jewish. But her cousin, Mordecai, has urged her to conceal this fact in the royal court. Now later on in the story, Mordecai uncovers a plot to kill the king. And he tells Esther about this and thus saves the life of the king in the process. But to their chagrin, the king doesn't immediately recognize Mordecai for the work that he's done. Instead, he promotes the person who becomes the villain of the plot, Haman. And Haman is promoted, and in his new role, he's second only to the king. And he expects everyone to bow down before him as he parades through the streets of the ancient city of Susa. But Mordecai refuses to do this. And Haman is angered, enraged. And he manages to convince the king that all the Jews in Persia are in a conspiracy to avoid keeping the laws that the king has proclaimed, and as evidenced by Mordecai's behavior. And while Haman is plotting to have Mordecai killed, the king actually reads about the work Mordecai has done to save his life. And before Haman can take action, the king instructs Haman to honor Mordecai by dressing him in royal robes and taking him around through the streets of the city. Not exactly what Haman wanted to do. Well, Esther, the hero of the story, risks her life by approaching the king. You couldn't even enter the king's court without being invited, even though she was his queen. She had to wait until he summoned her. But this was urgent business because Haman was planning to have all the Jews in the Persian Empire killed. So she took the risk of going into the king's chamber without being invited, and fortunately, he allowed it. And she revealed herself as being Jewish, and she revealed that Haman was already unleashing a plot to kill all the Jews in the Persian Empire. The king follows Esther to rescue The king then allows Esther to issue a decree on his behalf. He gives her his royal seal, says, write what you want, do what you want under my name. And on the very day that Haman had plotted to have the Jews destroyed, the Jews were then authorized to take vengeance upon their enemies. And so I quote here from chapter 8, verse 17. In every province, in every city, wherever the king commanded and his edict came, there was gladness and joy among the Jews, a festival and a holiday. They had been saved from extinction. And so today, Jews celebrate Purim with gifts to friends, charity for those in need, festive eating and drinking. There's a tradition in Purim of a spiel or a comic play. And I've got an example that I want to show you this morning. This was recorded by Hebrew students at the Hebrew Senior Service, actually. And there's a link to the original video. I had to cut it down quite a bit to get it in here, but I thought it was so much fun that I wanted to show it to you this morning. So if you want to see the whole thing, you can go to that link.
You all know the Bible, and you may think it's a snooze. No stories of resurrection, just guilt and krepwach for the Jews. But what if I were to tell you there's a fresh old story in there that's about a hip new lady who had a little Barbara Streisand? I'm going to take you back to biblical times, 5th century BCE. A Persian king named Ahasuerus threw a party that lasted for 180 days. Did they have enough vodka for all that time? They did, and he wanted Queen Vashti to dance.
What, it's her to dance?
But she said, no, I will not put on a show and trip the light fantastic. I'm a respectable woman, you know. So the king sat with his advisors and decreed that she would be a dancing queen. It was time for her to go.
Wow, he kicked her out because she wouldn't dance? That makes perfect sense.
Ahasuerus grew lonesome and set out upon a quest. And in the crowd, this king found the one he liked the best.
I need a brand new queen. Hey, Esther, you caught my eye.
Then appeared her cousin. His name was Mordecai.
I am Mordecai.
History. The king named Haman Judas for Mordecai, who earlier kept him safe. He heard of a plot to kill the king, reported Esther had been saved his life. And Esther said,
this is no lie, I've been at you all the time, and this man wants me dead. If you really like me and want me as your queen, you summon this out to do an evil deed and get him instead.
What do you mean?
You said?
Nope. Now comes a part of our story that wasn't in Haman's plan. Ahasuerus had him wiped out. The Jews became his biggest fans. Queen Esther almost died with her people. But with Mordecai's help, they won the day. And Esther wrote down this story, a book in the Bible called Megillat Esther. And there are four mitzvot before him. Sending gifts to friends, giving charity, eating a festive meal, and hearing this story. And now it's our job to tell you what happened to those Jews long ago.
Have you heard of the Oshanian heroes? They tried to kill us, but we won the tea. In America, do something incredible and read the story again.
Glad you enjoyed that. A little bit of fun. This is what seminary students do in their spare time. But again, it's a celebration. It's the one time in the Jewish year that they lighten up specifically and do this kind of thing and have these kinds of spiels, they call them, of play, usually with costumes. There are no costumes here, but a lot of humor and a lot of good fun and a lot of good food and celebration. Interestingly, I did learn from an excellent source that Purim is the only time of the year when drinking to excess is sanctioned by the rabbi.
Rest of mine, bring it up.
Now, there's a long-standing custom of, this is a quote from Wikipedia. There is a long-standing custom of drinking wine at the Feast of Purim. The custom stems from a statement in the Talmud attributed to a rabbi named Rava, who said one should drink on Purim until he can no longer distinguish between the cursed Haman and the blessed Mordecai. The drinking of wine features prominently in keeping with the jovial nature of the feast. This is based on the fact that the salvation of the Jews occurred through wine. Alcoholic consumption was later codified by the early authorities, and while some advocated total intoxication, rabbis haven't... I love talking to the rabbi because they find ways around everything, and they study, and they over centuries, they reflect on one another's comments. So this idea that someone had said you should drink until you couldn't distinguish Haman from Mordecai was... another rabbi saw as a problem. So alcoholic consumption was later codified. And while some advocated total intoxication, others consistent with the opinion of many early and later rabbis, taught that one should only drink a little more than usual and then fall asleep. Because whereupon one will certainly not be able to tell the difference between him and Mordecai. So there's a way around everything. So that ends the story of Purim. And I'm reflecting on our own traditions, Unitarian Universalist traditions. And we are still an evolving and developing and growing movement. We don't have an equivalent story like this that we celebrate. But we do have other things that we celebrate. I got down off my bookshelf a book that I don't often use, but I should use more often. This Day in Unitarian Universalist History. Every day of the year has a little story about something that you could celebrate if you wanted to. Today, in 1796, Joseph Priestley, who was a Unitarian, came from England, was the discoverer, I believe, of oxygen, and maybe had luck with circulation, early circulation. I'm looking at the doctor in the crowd, but I may be wrong on that. But Joseph Priestley, in 1796, founded the first separately organized Unitarian Church in America in Philadelphia.
He did.
So if you want something to celebrate today, you can celebrate that. On the 19th, we're having our picnic. And there's actually a very good reason to celebrate on the 19th. Let me find it here. The principles and purposes of the Unitarian Universalist Association, the major unifying religious statement of the denomination today, was adopted at the General Assembly in Atlanta, Georgia, on this day in 1985. So we have lots of things to celebrate. We have our own heroes, Francis David. We have Dr. Lotta Hitchmanova. I think having a day to celebrate Lotta would be wonderful. And we know how to celebrate. We celebrated our 175th birthday when I came here. And that's a story of heroism for the early Universalists who have founded this church in Calvinist Halifax in 1837. Took some considerable nerve. We also have, the last couple of years, Deborah's been organizing our own dinner theater as a celebration. And maybe next year we can videotape it and have our own little video that we can go viral with, hopefully. Well, we may not have an equivalent story to this. We do have our traditions. We do have reasons to celebrate, and it's good for us to do that. So I do hope that you will find time in your life, particularly during the summer months, for some blessed revelry. May it be so, and amen.